This is Jeff Blankfort with the September 28th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. In Monday night's Punch and Judy show, the first scheduled debate between presidential candidates Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, there was no mention of the record-breaking $38 billion gift package to Israel that President Obama announced 2 weeks ago. In fact, the only reference to Israel was Trump's remark that he had met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday, as had Clinton, who decided not to take opportunity to mention it, although at the time she gave her blessings to what had been euphemistically labeled by the White House as a memorandum of understanding between Washington and Tel Aviv. The decision of moderator Lester Holt not to inquire about the candidate's position on the latest giveaway to Israel should not have been surprising and was a favor to both. That's because there's no way that either Clinton or Trump could have justified it in the eyes of the majority of the American people, who are repeatedly being told that there's not enough money in the government's coffers to pay for many of the essentials, the absence of which impacts their lives. Joining in this conspiracy of silence has been NPR, which relies on congressional appropriations for a major part of its funding, and Congress, as I have pointed out on more than one occasion, is perhaps Israel's most important occupied territory. The pressures of funding also affect Democracy Now!, which only mentioned it briefly in passing yesterday or Monday in reporting Trump's meeting with Netanyahu. While Democracy Now! Has provided outstanding and unparalleled coverage of the resistance by the Sioux and their allies to oil drilling in North Dakota, and is on the scene in all the cities where black men and youths have been murdered by police, Amy Goodman, too, must think about her own sources of funds when the power of the Israel lobby is part of the story. Fortunately, this is not the case with me, Takes on the World, or KZYX, which for nearly 16 years has given me the freedom to do the kind of programming that I do, while acknowledging before every program that my views are purely my own and not the station's. That's why today I'll be speaking about that massive arms package for Israel with a frequent guest, former CIA field officer and analyst Phil Giraldi, who just yesterday penned an article on the subject for the UNS Review entitled, appropriately, Israel's $38 Billion Scam. That will be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that, while in the meantime I'll provide you with some other information on that subject which you probably haven't heard. In his article, Girardi notes that groveling to Israel is in the American political DNA. Even progressive groups that claim to be supportive of Palestinian rights and opposed to growing fascism in Israel exhibit the usual ambivalence when it comes to issues that might actually have an impact, he writes. They go silent and become curiously absent from the debate, end quote. By coincidence, this was the subject of an article of my own that appeared Monday on Dissident Voice, entitled Bennis's Delusions of Massive Opposition to Israel Evaporate Under Harsh Light of Reality, end quote. The Bennis I refer to, of course, is Phyllis Bennis, who is considered one of the experts on the Middle East and appears regularly on Democracy Now! And on the Real News Network, one of the best alternative news sources. She was also my guest on the very first edition of Takes on the World back in January 2001. What prompted my article was her comment in an interview on the Real News Network on September 14th, the day that Obama announced the arms deal for Israel. And she said, quote, "There is massive opposition to Israeli actions in the United States today, particularly importantly in the Jewish community, where there's been an enormous shift in the discourse," end quote. I was bewildered by that statement since it is profoundly untrue, and one only had to look at the absence of any opposition to the $38 billion arms package, despite the fact that it had been discussed in the Israeli and U.S. media for more than a year before Obama's announcement. She then went on to portray the elimination in the Democratic Platform Committee of statements critical of Israeli occupation and the ongoing construction of Jewish settlements as a victory. As a victory. Here's what I found mind-boggling, she said, quote, "The public discourse on the subject has shifted," she said. "We saw that during the debate over the language on Israel and Palestine in the Democratic Party platform," end quote. Does she take us for fools? Apparently so, but I'm not sure how many more victories like that the Palestinians can afford. If you wish to read my entire article, do an online search for Blankfort, Bennis, and Dissident Voice in any order. You'll find it. What's equally astonishing about the latest gift to Israel is that two of Israel's leading political figures who enjoy favorable opinions on Capitol Hill, Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak and recently fired Defense Minister Moshe Bugi Yalon had the nerve to attack Netanyahu for not getting even more money. Seriously. Writing in the Washington Post on the day before the deal was announced, Barak first attacked Netanyahu for having, quote, enabled a militant nationalist minority to carry out a hostile takeover of his party, Likud, to form a majority in his cabinet and thus to hijack our national agenda in the service of a messianic drive toward, as is often put, a single Jewish state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, end quote. And he said, Netanyahu's reckless conduct, he went on, has also undermined Israel's security. Israel has reached a new military aid agreement for the next decade with the United States. The damage produced by Netanyahu's irresponsible management of the relations with the White House is now fully manifest. Israel will receive $3.8 billion a year, an important contribution to our security, Barak acknowledged, but far less than what would have been obtained before the prime minister chose to blatantly interfere with U.S. politics. End quote. He then went on to complain that with a rise in the cost of weaponry since the last 10-year plan, the fact that the current deal represents a $700 billion annual increase, quote, the newly agreed-upon amount represents no greater purchasing power, and even these funds will be conditioned on Israel refraining from requesting additional funding from Congress, end quote. This was apparently intended by Obama to stem Israel's greed by throwing a monkey wrench into its traditional ability to manipulate Congress whenever it wishes. Additionally, complained Barak, Israel will have to accept a gradual reduction of more than $750 million a year in funds for our defense industries. Consequently, either vital security projects will be canceled or the same amount will be reduced from important domestic programs. End quote. I should point out Israel's domestic programs include free health care and higher education, which he and other Israelis apparently believe the U.S. should subsidize. Those words are Ehud Barak's. The next day, former Defense Minister Yalon spoke to the Washington Institute for Middle East Studies, or excuse me, Near East Peace, excuse me, a 30-year-old APAC-spawned think tank which Yalon joined in Washington after being fired from his post. As the English language Times of Israel reported, Yalon joined Barak Thursday in questioning the military aid deal, saying the $38 billion, Washington's largest defense package to any country in history, is still not enough to meet all of Israel's security needs. The former defense minister, who was effectively ousted from his position earlier this year amid a political crisis that saw Avigdor Lieberman, a one-time Moldavian beer hall bouncer with no military experience, take his place, he suggested that while the deal saw Israel receive all the capabilities he had negotiated for in 2015, the sum total of the package still fell short. Put it another way, said Yalon, I don't think $38 billion will provide all the required capabilities or meet all our needs. Israel will now have to go through a prioritization process to see what we can get and what we prefer to leave aside, he added. Well, it might not turn out as badly for Israel as Barak and Yalon projected to be. Led by Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, the ninth poorest state in the Union with a poverty rate of 18.6% and a childhood poverty rate of 27.3%, there are a handful of members of Congress who are ready to respond to Barak and Yalon by arguing that Israel should get yet more than the $38 billion. Moreover, they want the U.S. to restore the provision that had been in previous arms packages to Israel that would allow it to spend at least a quarter of the money on its own weapons industry that is now competing with the U.S. in the global arms market. Reuters reported that Graham and three other Republican senators announced last Tuesday that they would seek to overturn parts of the military aid agreement with Israel, setting up a showdown with Obama over the final outcome of the package. Graham, with Kelly Ayotte, John McCain, and Ted Cruz, told a news conference they wanted to add a measure giving Israel an additional $1.5 billion in military aid to a bill expected later this year to renew U.S. sanctions on Iran. Arguing that Congress, not the administration, sets spending policy under U.S. law, they objected to a provision in the agreement that would prevent Israel from asking for additional funds from Congress after the new Memorandum of Understanding begins at the end of fiscal 2018. the beginning of fiscal 2018. This is a very dramatic moment in the U.S.-Israel relationship between Congress and the State of Israel, declared Graham. Congress is not going to sit on the sidelines, end quote. The four senators also object to Israel's agreement to return any money if Congress tries to send in more than $3.8 billion per year before then. Graham also said he would introduce legislation to overturn a provision in the agreement that phased out the special arrangement previously noted that has allowed Israel for decades to use 26.3% of the U.S. aid on its own defense industry instead of on U.S. weapons. After more than 10 months of often bitter negotiations, Netanyahu decided it would be best to forge a new arrangement with Obama, who leaves office in January, rather than hoping for better terms from the next U.S. administration, according to officials on both sides. The senators insisted that Netanyahu had been forced into signing because they claim that Israel's archenemy, Iran, is growing stronger as it obtains billions of dollars unfrozen under the nuclear agreement reached last year. Now is not the time to say they were going to nickel and dime Israel, Graham said. Well, that fate apparently is reserved for the people of his home state and the rest of the United States. Since then, Senators Marco Rubio, Mark Kirk, and Roy Blunt have added their names to the bill that is now starting to move through the Senate. I'll try and keep you posted on this story because you're not likely to hear about it from anyone else. Speaking of the Senate, you probably haven't heard, but on September 19th, 88 senators, including both Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, as well as vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine, signed a letter drafted by AIPAC to President Obama, calling on him to, quote, make it clear that you will veto any one-sided UN Security Council resolution that may be offered in the coming months, end quote. I told you Congress was Israeli occupied, didn't I? While on the subject of U.S. arms for Israel, I neglected to mention that following the announcement of the arms deal, the U.S. Air Force confirmed the transfer of an additional 10 Boeing F-15D fighters to Israel at no cost to Tel Aviv. The 10 F-15Ds, which cost the taxpayers, U.S. taxpayers, $28 million a pop, are considered excess articles and not counted as foreign military sales. The USAF has delivered 8 to Israel so far, according to the website Flight Global. Well, this is as good a time as any, I guess, to inject a little humor, admittedly dark humor, into this commentary. Last Thursday night at New York's prestigious Plaza Hotel, the Hudson Institute honored Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu with his 2016 Herman Kahn Award, which is presented to leading public servants who exemplify a commitment to Western alliances as a bedrock of global security, prosperity, and freedom. Their words, not mine. I expect most of you are old enough to remember Stanley Kubrick's 1979 film, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Well, Dr. Strangelove, of course, was modeled after the Hudson Institute's founder, Herman Kahn, the military strategist and physicist who, while working with the RAND Corporation, advocated the theory during the Cold War that a nuclear war with the Soviet Union was winnable, not unthinkable. His title of Dr. Strangelove was later passed on to Henry Kissinger, who himself had been a Herman Kahn Award winner, as were Ronald Reagan, Rupert Murdoch, Dick Cheney, and Joseph Lieberman. I think there are a few people who would argue that Netanyahu is not deserving to be linked with such world-famous luminaries. The biggest luminary Monday night's debate in terms of girth as well as wealth was the uber-rich Las Vegas based billionaire Sheldon Adelson. Earlier in the year, Adelson had promised Donald Trump $100 million for his campaign, but until recently there had been no sign of it. Now there's an unconfirmed report that he will provide Trump with a mere $25 million to help him through Election Day, since Donald has changed his tune regarding Israel, whose welfare is Adelson's prime political concern. Earlier in the campaign, Trump stated that he would, quote, be even-handed in his treatment of the Israelis and Palestinians, an act of political naivete that he made sure to reverse. The statement, that's reversal of the statement, the change of heart, were received with indifference by his political base, but not by potential supporters among America's Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, where his right-wing racist views toward Muslims and Mexican immigrants have been warmly welcomed. But this item is not about Trump, but about one of his leading advisors, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who was seen at the debate literally kissing Adelson's ring. It was probably done in jest, wrote Douglas Bloomfield, a former AIPAC staff member in the Jerusalem Post, but may have been intended to help shake loose some of Sheldon's shekels for Trump. Well, finally, we have Facebook coming out, so to speak, as another Israeli asset. For some time, the number of people who have had their accounts blocked by Facebook for posting criticism of Israel, which could no way be construed as anti-Semitic, has been on the increase, as I heard from friends and relatives. Finally, it happened to me when I responded to a post on a Facebook page accusing a well-known Israeli-born critic of his country's racist policies, former Takes on the World guest Michael Pellid, of being the favorite of racists and white supremacists. For suggesting in reply that Pellid's attacker was, quote, doing damage control for AIPAC, I found myself blocked for 24 hours for violating Facebook's community standards with no functioning means of appeal. In Israel, Facebook has been cooperating with Israeli authorities to suppress the social media tool as a means of communication and organizing resistance where numerous checkpoints make moving from village to village close to impossible. In 2015, Facebook took down 431 pieces of content that it said violated harassment laws or denied the Holocaust, which is against the law in Israel. And in Facebook's report on government requests shows that last year it handed overuse of data to Israeli authorities for about 60% of the 468 requests it received. In Norway, Facebook faced a storm from the readers of Aftenposten, the country's leading newspaper, when it deleted a post by writer Tom Egeland that featured the terror of war, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph by Nick Ut that showed children, including the naked 9-year-old Kim Fook, running away from a U.S. napalm attack during the Vietnam War. You've probably seen it. Egeland was subsequently suspended from Facebook. When Aftenposten reported on the suspension, using the same photograph it then shared on its Facebook page, the newspaper received a message from Facebook asking it to either remove or pixelize the photograph. Any photographs of people displaying a fully nude genitalia or buttocks or fully nude female breasts will be removed, and notice on Facebook explains. Before Aftenposten could respond, Facebook deleted the article and image from the newspaper's Facebook page. At 10 a.m. Sunday morning, October 9th, in celebration of John Lennon's birthday, there will be a live international speak out against political censorship by Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, at his San Francisco mansion, 3452 21st Street near Dolores Street. So they're going to get in Mark Zuckerberg's face. The theme will be Imagine a Day Without Censorship, and it'll be live streamed. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.